This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. Two very different writers this morning, David.
Very different. I've got an existential crisis coming on. Here we go.
Well, I've got cows.
You've got cows? Well, that makes more sense.
You know, how do you feel about cows? Just as good to eat? Or do you appreciate the milk? When you get up close, they're very big. So friendly or afraid. These are just some of the animals on A Farm in Golden Clouds with the author Liana Shaw. Liana, welcome.
Hi, Jen. Thanks for having me.
And now we're not going to make Liana nervous, but first radio chat, debut book. Oh, but she'll hammer it. Indian Ben are doing some work on the farm just before sunrise, and we're going to go straight in for a description.
By the time they reached the main herd, the world had begun to reveal itself, and Ben seemed much more relaxed behind her. In the ghostly glow of a sun not yet visible, the land took on a strange, otherworldly sheen. Mist clung to the earth and circled the roots of the gums, which rose from the gloom like ancient kings. Shapes emerged from the darkness, cows grazing, kangaroos standing alert and watchful, a lone wombat poised to run. Everything was still, as if the farm held its breath, waiting for the first caress of light. And then the sun broke the horizon and lashings of gold light bathed the land. Where there had been grey and darkness, now colour exploded. The bright orange and pink sky, the gum trees painted deep browns and vivid greens, the paddocks glistening with morning dew, the dam surface a glittering jewel beneath a faint mist. "Like a farm in the clouds," he murmured, and when Indy turned to gaze across the land, she realised it did look as if the farm was suspended above the rest of the world, hovering in the sky. The sun suddenly broke free, drenching the hills in sunlight and casting a golden glow across the clouds that unfurled towards the horizon. "A farm in golden clouds," he amended, mirroring her thoughts. He turned suddenly and caught her watching him, and when he smiled, Indy found herself smiling back.
Well, Indy is Indiana Carmichael, and you can tell with that that she just loves this farm, as do her 16-year-old son Noah and 8-year-old daughter Ollie. But what's happened to their father, their much-loved husband Michael?
So when we meet Indy, it's been 2 years since she lost her husband. They had moved to this beautiful farm, to Manigum Farm, with great plans to turn it into a cattle farm that sold ethically raised and grass-fed beef cattle. And then 3 weeks later, there was an accident on the farm and Indy and her kids lost their husband and father.
So she spent these last 2 years grieving, but also writing about her grief. So what's happened now?
So in between the 101 things she has to do around the farm every day, Indy dealt with her grief by writing down her thoughts and feelings in this journal. After a while, she started to reread that journal and realised it was quite good, and she ended up sharing it with her best friend, who told her that it was probably good enough to be published.
And this is Carlene. Now, Carlene and Indy are very good friends, and their friendship often happens over a bottle or two of wine.
Absolutely.
I know it's developed.
Carlene is super loyal, and her methods of helping Indy probably aren't orthodox, but she does get Indy off the farm and to the pub, so it does work out in the end.
Indy was thrilled about the money she got in advance for the book, and also now there's possible book sales. So what's her problem financially?
So her problem is that before her husband died, he made a terrible business deal, and he signed that in the business name of which Indy was listed as director. So that ended up going to court, and they were given a big fine. And because Indy was also director of that company, she is now responsible for that fine. She has been lucky enough to work out a payment plan to pay that back. But with her farm barely breaking even, she doesn't know how she's going to manage to pay that as well.
Well, it's just Indy and the accountant who know about the financial ruin she's facing. Why doesn't Indy want to tell Michael's parents?
I think Indy feels that her, you know, Michael's parents have already been through so much, and they have rallied around her and the children. They have given up their retirement to help her on the farm and to help her raise her kids. So she doesn't want to ruin their memories of their son by dragging his name through the mud and telling them what this big mistake that he did before he passed away.
The beauty of the farm in Kestrel Creek, the locality, is also appreciated by Ben Whitman. But he's there for a very different reason.
Yes, so Ben is an actor. He rose to fame when he filmed this action role 2 years prior in the weeks following his own wife's passing. He threw himself into this role so that he didn't have to worry about this grief, so that he could be Rogue Barclay, this action hero, instead of Ben Whitman, this widow.
He also has a very young son, Will. What type of kid is Will?
Will's a quiet kid. He's an anxious kid. He was very young when he lost his mother. He didn't really understand what was happening. And when Ben threw himself into filming to cope with his own grief, Will effectively lost his mother and his father. And this anxiety over losing people he loves ends up manifesting in these anxious nightmares that keep him awake all night.
So now they're filming in Kestrel Creek, and Ben has decided to bring his son and his mum, and he also his manager, who's Amali, who's his best friend now, all out to sort of stay in this little cottage in the township. And you'd think it would be good and safe, but a library would be a safe place too. Indy's going to have her book launch at this library. And then she's there with her son and daughter, and they find a book that Michael, the husband, used to read to them as young kids. So she settles even the big gawky 16-year-old, and they sit around and she reads this book. But somebody else is listening.
Yes, so Ben has taken his son Will down to find a book that he can read for school. Here's Indy reading this wonderful story to her children, and I think it's whether he misses, you know, he never had a mother who read to him, and he is just spellbound.
So when the family, Indy and her two kids, leave, Will follows.
He does. And Indy doesn't even realise until they're quite a while away, when they do finally realise that Will has followed because he wants to find out what happens in this story, Indy instantly picks up this kid and races back.
So she arrives. She's got hair everywhere. She's got this kid in her arm. She's running. And, of course, Ben, Will's dad, comes out. What's his reaction?
Ben is, you know, he lost his wife, so he has this fear of failing as a father and not being able to look after Will properly. So when he realises that Will is missing, he's called the police. He feels like he's absolutely failed, and that anger at himself is starting to erupt. And so when he sees this woman with Will in her arms, he mistakenly believes that she has taken him because he is a celebrity and she wants to get to him.
Let's have a little look at page 36 because, it, you know, you just in one paragraph you sum up his anger and his...
Ben spun to the woman, his fury hot and liquid. He's just a kid. If you wanted to get to me, then come after me. I might be a public figure, but my life and my family aren't a free-for-all. Have some decency. The woman who'd stolen his son flinched as if Ben had slapped her, her cheeks flushing with shame.
Not a good way to start a relationship at all. Indy, she's doing her book launch and the publicist wants a second book about a happy, successful life, but Indy doesn't feel like she could write that and she needs to write something in 10 weeks. She's got Ollie wetting the bed with the 8-year-old wetting the bed again and Noah not being a normal teenager. He's chopping wood and he's missing out with his friends. We've talked about Indy and her loss. What happened with Ben's wife?
So Ben's wife passed away from cancer. She lasted only 8 weeks. So that comparison to Indy, who lost her husband instantly, Ben tried to shield Will from a lot of that.
Oh, yes, yeah. At the book launch, it's a packed bookshop and everybody's there. And once again, Ben takes the limelight.
He does. So he didn't want to go, but his sister-in-law convinced him to go down to this book launch because it was about a widow who had survived that first year. And Ben at this point is trying to get his life back on script. So he's willing to do anything, but he does turn up to this book launch, recognises Indy, and then a lot of people end up recognising him.
So instead of Indy being the focus, he is. And there's a bit of a mob stir and she just saves him again.
She does. She's making a habit of saving Ben.
Ben offers an apology family day out at an amusement park with fast access tickets to all the rides. So, you know, Nora and Ollie are very impressed. But it's Indy who achieves something with Ben's son, Will.
She does. And this is meant to be a day where Ben thanks Indy for all her help. But Indy sees her children enjoying these rides and just being quite free instead of bogged down by, you know, all the grief and everything that they're trying to get through. So she tries to repay him by helping get Will onto a ride, because Will, you know, is quite an anxious kid. He doesn't like rides. So she ends up getting him on the Ferris wheel.
Oh, well, Ben thought Indy may be able to help him with his own grief. And this is a quote. "You speak about your husband as if he's still here, and I want that for Will. I just don't know how to do it. I never talk about her. I don't want to upset Will. I'm sick of feeling like this, like every good moment can't last, because soon I'll remember she's not there to share it." And we know that for Indy, there's so many things that Noah has missed with Michael.
Absolutely, and especially with footy, which is Noah's, you know, it's his thing that he loves. So we find out later that he has given up football to try and help Indy around the farm, to spend that extra time around the farm to help his mother out of a sense of grief and of guilt.
Well, we know parenting's hard, and writing, this is a quote, "she had never written anything before she'd earned that unlucky and unwanted badge of widowhood." But she has Ray Darling, her publisher, who's taken a chance on her and wants a second novel. Ben offers to give some advice to Indy about her ideas for this second novel at a dinner, but even the small town of Kestrel Creek has paparazzi and social media gossip. What are some of the assertions that come out of this very innocent dinner?
So they go to this dinner to, you know, Ben's going to try and help Indy find this idea that she can pitch to write this second novel. And she thinks it goes quite well, but she wakes up to her best friend Carlene calling her, all these missed calls, and the local paparazzi has struck again, and all these newspapers have taken on these stories about how Ben is now engaged to this writer from Kestrel Creek. You know, they've even taken more license and liberties and said that they're now pregnant. So Indy's now Indy's woken up. She's now engaged. She's apparently pregnant to this this famous actor that has only been in town for you know, not that long at all. So it's quite a way to wake up, especially when she's forgotten to set her alarm and she's now hours behind with her farm work.
Oh, look, it's funny. And the humour in this, Carlene, we mentioned before, is always wants to push her best friend. Let's hear here.
"I saw Josh at the IGA yesterday," Carlene said. Indy frowned. "Josh? Josh Briney. You remember him from school." A skinny boy with greasy hair flashed through her memory. "The one who always picked his nose?" Carlene rolled her eyes. "When he was 10. He owns a mechanic shop in Creswick now." "Okay, what about him?" "I hear he's recently divorced." "Carlene." She shrugged at the warning in Indy's tone. "You'll never know if you never go."
This unpublished manuscript won the Emerald Award from the Romance Writers of Australia. And I can understand why. Oh, Liana, it's just a delight. It's a delight that you get involved with the characters, and there was a tear for me. So you've got a few more books coming out now.
I do. So it's my second book, which I'm actually starting edits on in a couple of weeks. So that's exciting. That will be out in 2027.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
A farmer and a movie star, both trying hard to parent their problem kids and both having their much loved spouses die. What future could there be for them in such different lifestyles? A Farm in the Golden Clouds, a second time around love story by Liana Shaw. Delightful.
Thank you, Jan. And from getting a life going back on script to a life falling apart in the novel I have, in Michael Winkler's latest novel, Grief Dog, Geoffrey Watson Johnson becomes Hubert. What that transition means is what we hope to explore in this interview. So, Michael, welcome to 3CR.
Many thanks, David.
Geoffrey Watson Johnson is a hydrologist, and Michael's just taken a sip of water in preparation. And we'll come to that notion of water in a minute, but he's just come into some very good fortune at the beginning of the novel. What is it, and what does it trigger?
Well, David, I think I'm pretty sure this is the only novel in history that's used this idea of a distant aunt dying and giving you a large inheritance. I think it's wholly original. So Geoffrey is this striving man who lives a very effortful life, doing his best in most parts of his life, but I don't think there's a lot of joy. And
well, getting on to that effortful, because he has a liaison with Pam, who's his cousin, who's also inherited, and there's something about KPIs and performance orientation, but what's it in association with?
Well, once again, it's this idea of effortfulness, and he's striving for excellence in all realms of his life, and I don't know if he's falling short, but he's certainly failing to live an enjoyable life.
Because this was the she was rocking her pelvis and starting to quiver from toes to top, and he was not worried about increased limpness, but a whole different problem, because this was feedback more thrilling than he needed. A master of sex should at least be able to prolong things indefinitely, and he searched his addled brain, frantic for distraction. So he's sort of performance oriented.
Thank you so much for reading that part, David. Yes.
But this then gets onto the notion of water and him being a hydrologist, because this sort of permeates the entire text. You have three sections in this text: tortuosity, hyporheric zone, and capillary motion. And this sort of notion of water resonates through the entire text. But it's there in the style of writing as well. And I'll just, another little passage here. Which Geoffrey can I represent? Which Hubert? Do I take the tide of affairs at the flood or at low water at different points between? As for leading on to fortune, well, not really. I should have found out his football team. These people love an exuant to the strains of the fabled singers. Khan and Bruce Dawes' Chicken Smallhorn returning like the maze god. I met a woman once who danced with Chicken Smallhorn. You've got this layering in the way you're writing, which is flowing through like water. Well, I think we'll keep using that imagery. But there are all sorts of cultural references here. Affairs at the Flood comes from Shakespeare.
That's right. Yeah.
And Bruce Dawe?
Comes from Bruce Dawe. And we're here in Fitzroy at the moment. And so that famous poem, Life Cycle.
Life Cycle, when children are born in Victoria, wrapped in the club colours. But these are all the sort of backdrop things to people's lives that permeate throughout people's lives that you've got here, which I think is quite important. Because we then, that's the sort of background, performance-oriented character. But in the second section, hyperheric zone, I think we firstly need an explanation of what hyperheric is.
I spent a lot of time reading about water science before I wrote this book. I do not have a scientific background, but that's the idea of the zone beside terrestrial water, streams, rivers, where it bleeds and mingles with groundwater. So the water beneath the surface that we never see. So it's that mingled zone.
Well, that goes into the description beforehand, where we're an amalgam of mingling references that take place. But in this section, Geoffrey makes a decision. I don't want to be me, he says. What does he want to be?
Well, he decides that he wants to withdraw from his life as it is lived, and the solution he comes up with is to remain living within his family, but as the family pet. That doesn't mean that he's dressing as a dog. It doesn't mean that he's eating as a dog. It doesn't mean that he's taken on walks. It means that he has no rights, but also no responsibilities. And he signs over the inheritance to his wife. So there are no financial difficulties there, and decides that what he wants is that he will remain there in the family unit and within the community, really, without any obligations.
Is this an existential crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that a lot of us have had this this desire to withdraw from our lives, As I say to my wife regularly, I would like to take a holiday, but away from myself. And unfortunately, we always take ourselves with us wherever we go.
It means I don't want to work. I don't want to be a hydrologist. Don't want to be prayers of try harder. Don't want to make representations to council or sponsor funding submissions or sit on community commissions. I don't even, and this is the hardest, well, all of it's the hardest, but I don't want to be a husband and I don't want to be a father. I don't want to be Jeffrey. This whole notion of the forces that are imposed on our lives in terms of how we should lead, are we ever able to break free from those?
Well, that's what he tries to do. And what we discover throughout the book is that to some limited extent, you can withdraw from your life, you can withdraw from the world. But ultimately, we live in a community. We live with other people, and it's a very blunt instrument. What he's come up with as his solution to his existential crisis, but it doesn't take him where he expects it to take him, and it doesn't allow him to have whatever that sort of non-life is that he seems to be seeking.
His son, Byrne, calls it performative helplessness. But yes, he's just chosen a different way of existing. I was over it all, trying to be my best, racing to this, competing for that, getting head up about this or that civic spat, and then all the bigger worries. You try looking at water data all day and not get fixated about the climate crisis. I mean, it's happening. It's happened, whether I worry about it or not. The crisis doesn't need me to pay attention. So I was, after a way, to not have to do or think anything. So he's sort of withdrawing from the world. But can you actually ever do that? Because there are these references to water that you have, and it's always there. It's always present.
Well, our brains are 73% water, they tell me. So Jeffrey is living in Mildura, and he's a water scientist in Mildura, and that means that all day long he's paying attention to the climate crisis. Mildura earlier this year was 49 degrees, and that's something that is going to recur. So the impacts of the climate crisis are a lot more immediate in somewhere like that.
Well, politically, we've got the Murray-Darling Basin crisis, would you call it? Or
would say it's been a crisis for 50 years and probably longer.
But here we go with then all of these references to water. Does water have memory?
Well, this is a point we get to late in the book, and perhaps you have to go along, if I can say, his journey. You have to travel as far as he travels psychologically and intellectually, and end up as troubled and as far out as he is, I think, before you ask those questions and perhaps before you come to the answers that he tentatively comes to. But yes, I mean, it does it. I don't know. Do you think it does, David?
Well, the way you've portrayed it, I think it does. I mean, when you look at the descriptions, fossil groundwater is water that infiltrated prior to the Holocene. It constitutes the majority of water in aquifers deeper than 250 metres. Below 500 metres, there is water with residence times of millions of years. And so there's that water that's infiltrated, a bit like the cultural references that have infiltrated.
A massive tick to you. That's exactly the parallel I'm trying to draw. So the scrolling backwards, the piece you read earlier that referred to Shakespeare and to Bruce Dorr and so forth, there's three narratives streams in this book, and two of them are first person narratives, just to confuse matters. And one of them is me, myself, and it's close enough to me, myself. The next is a character which is related to me, which is the person preparing for a funeral and trying to think through what they're going to do. And so there is bleeding, as in an hyperhoric zone, between the me character and the other first person I character. And part of that is cultural. And it's this idea that books come from books and writing comes from writing. And if I sit down to write, the imagery that comes to me filters through everything that I've read or heard. And so that's why there's snatches of these.
But it also goes beyond you, mm-hmm. that it's there inherent mm-hmm. in who we are. Mm-hmm. I mean, you even have biblical references here. Genesis 7:11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, all the fountains of the deep burst forth. Mm-hmm. So there's even a sort of religious overtone in these stories that have come up through the rock, because, you know, it's compressed. The water is compressed into the rock.
Well, if we're trying to understand water, we have to look at the science and at the scientific thinking, but we also have to look at the way that water has been used culturally, and obviously the Bible is a huge part of that. And Seneca, for example, wrote about water, was trying to work out how groundwater functioned and what it was. So there's this vast cultural history that we're writing into and thinking into.
Seneca was fascinated with the idea of vast caverns beneath the earth, linked by arteries of subterranean air and water, finding an analogy in the way veins moved blood through the human body. So at this point, we now have an anthropomorphic connection between who we are and the earth, which even goes back past the indigenous, etc. It goes back into time immemorial in many ways, in the way you're telling this story. And all of this came from an inheritance that Jeffrey received.
Well, as Liana knows, you want to be read, but you also want to be read well. And I just thank you for the fact that you're seeing everything that has been sort of infused into this narrative.
Well, I don't think I've got it all. this is the problem, because there's another thing, because the book begins at a funeral, but we don't quite know who the funeral is for, and the ending is sort of it's not necessarily a funeral, but a parting, but a beginning. And so the beginning of the novel is the end, and the end is the beginning, and there are all of these sorts of things going on structurally as well.
A number of people have told me that as soon as they finished it, they went back and started reading the start again, perhaps to make sense of what they hadn't initially apprehended.
Well, yeah, that notion, because also then that notion of Geoffrey, who is now Hubert, because he's changed, well, he was named by his wife, Hubert, as the dog. But so there are almost two voices at the beginning. But yes, all of this makes sense if you bring a glass of water to the fore and how it all permeates through. So it really is, well, I've described it as a delta of a novel, really, in terms of how it all...
I'll hold on to that one. Thank you, David.
Because all the streams, rivulets, and the way it's all permeating through, never having, well, sort of having a single direction, but able to go out in various paths.
Which links, again, I think it's not a message book, but I think if there is something in it, it's that we can't really escape each other and that we have to look after each other, there's those linkages.
But what we have to do is return to the mundane and basically finish the show for the day.
Yeah. In Liana's book, there was also the connection of water and grief and how, well, can you explain it?
So obviously Manigun Farm is running along a river, and Indy uses the analogy that, you know, she was standing in the middle of the river just being bombarded by that flow of water. But now, a couple of years later, she's standing on the banks and the water's still running over her feet, but she's able to be a bit more free.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so water permeates everything. So Grief Dog is a sprawling, enigmatic, idiosyncratic and dialectic journey, and it's from Text Publishing, Jan.
Well, I just had a romance rural. Liana Shaw, A Farm in Golden Clouds by Alan and Unwin.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.